that they have developed in NASA works reasonably well. Ken Mattingly, as he's called here, did not get to go, but his replacement, John Swigert, did really exceptionally well in a very difficult trip. The second thing is that the accident itself showed the reliability of the equipment in an interesting way. There used to be a joke in the early days of the space program about an astronaut sitting on the launch pad waiting for the rocket to go off, thinking that this, after all, was a rocket that had been assembled only by low bidders. And they all are like that. And while there was a breakdown, a mysterious breakdown, an unforeseen breakdown on Apollo 13, those low bidders did, after all, in terms of the LEM, in terms of the command module, in terms of the launch vehicle, make a lot of equipment that worked really pretty well in an emergency. And from my own point of view, Frank, it just seems to me that this is very important to keep in mind. One thing broke, the other things worked superbly, and I think this is one of the lessons from Apollo 13. We'll be back after this message from Gulf.
This is where it's at, the winner's circle. Champagne, trophies, beautiful girls. But this is where you make it all possible. Rain-soaked tracks in the shadow of empty stands. This is where the new racing team of Gulf and Porsche ran the final tests of the Gulf Porsche 917. Everything had to perform, including the motor oil, Gulf Pride Formula G. Here they learned the truth about men, machines, and Formula G. They had to. Soon they would go for the trophies and champagne. Daytona, the first big race of 1970. And the first big win for Gulf Porsche. Everything did perform, including Gulf Pride Formula G. Try it.
One of the other NBC News correspondents who spent this hectic week with us was Jim Hartz. And among his specialties, scale models. Jim?
Frank, it takes a lot of brute power to get Apollo 13 to the moon and back. The Saturn rocket that does the job is a vehicle that's often described in superlatives. In short, it is the biggest and most powerful rocket in the world. The vehicle that launched Apollo 13 toward the moon stood 363 feet tall. That's about the distance from home plate to the bullpen in left field. At liftoff, the rocket produced 7.5 million pounds of thrust to propel the 100,000-pound Apollo toward orbit. The first stage burned for 2 minutes and 40 seconds, consuming enough propellant to fill the tanks of 500,000 automobiles. When it's empty, it was dropped off. The launch escape tower went next. It would have pulled the astronauts away from the booster in case of a malfunction during the launch. The second stage, which took over at 220,000 feet, burned for about 8 minutes. Then it, too, was jettisoned, leaving the third stage, the boost itself, the command module, the service module, and the lunar landing craft into a 100-mile orbit. Shortly after that, another maneuver called translunar injection was performed. More on that later. But then up 100 or 200 miles above the Earth, we find a configuration something like this. The main spacecraft, the service propulsion system, and the lunar module, we've stripped away some of the protective covering, and that is hooked to the Saturn third stage. Then a maneuver called transposition and docking is performed. Transposition is a high-class word meaning to move away from. Then the spacecraft makes a 180-degree turn, comes back, docks with the lunar module, and pulls it out of its protective casing. Now, when that maneuver was performed last Saturday, the astronauts inside the command module turned on their TV camera and gave us all a look at the maneuver.
Now, this is a view of the Saturn third stage, and the lunar module is coming to us from about 5,000 miles beyond Earth. The spacecraft and S-4B traveling at a speed of about 22,900 feet per second at this time.
Okay, Joe, I'm pointing over toward Jack, and it's pretty bright with the Earth out that window. Is it sort of washing out the picture here?
No, Fred, it's not. We've got a bright spot where the window is. The rest of you are semi-silhouette. It's a pretty impressive picture. That's a good picture, Fred.
Yeah, we're just about there. About 10 more feet now.
Roger.
Everything looks pretty good down in the S-4B to the shroud. Still looks intact down there.
Good deal. There's really quite a bit of detail in this picture.
From Earth orbit, Apollo 13 had to boost into a coasting orbit towards the moon. This is called the translunar injection, and the burn came at 4:48 Saturday afternoon Eastern Time, 2 hours, 35 minutes, and 45 seconds after the launch. The engine firing boosted their speed from orbital velocity to escape velocity, and they were on their way to the moon. Sunday evening, 30 hours out from the Earth, the astronauts were 138,000 miles from home, traveling at 3,200 miles an hour. The course they were on is what is called a free return trajectory, so that if they did nothing more, they would loop around the moon and head back to Earth. But to reach the Frau Mauro region of the moon, their destination, they had to give up their free return and go into a hybrid trajectory. And they accomplished this with a small engine burn at 8:54 Sunday night. If they did nothing more in this hybrid trajectory, they would loop around the moon, but on return would miss the Earth by 40,000 miles. They didn't know it at the time, but later on they would want desperately to get out of that hybrid mode and back to a free return. And we'll see what happened after this message from Gulf.
This is the year for Canada, a country that's anything you want. Shakespearean theater, modern art, a resort hotel, or a camper's paradise. A North American Switzerland. Or the whole different world of French-speaking Quebec, where Quebec City is like being in Paris, but without Paris prices. Canada is also where you'll now find more than 5,000 Gulf stations coast to coast. And now you can use your Gulf travel card to see Canada and pay later, charging rooms and meals at Holiday Inns, meals at Wayfarer restaurants, and car expenses. And don't forget Gulf Special Services, called Tour Guide, that can give you map, motel, restaurant, and sightseeing information. Let Gulf, the travel agency with pumps, help you see what's right next door in Canada.
Last Monday night, the astronauts were intent on their mission of landing on the moon, as they showed in this television transmission fed back to us here on Earth.
Leva, which has also been shown before. It's a head garment for wearing out on the surface. And I'm bringing Jim's out here to show a couple of mods. One problem before is that the cast of characters out on the surface haven't been able to be distinguished apart very well. So not only Jim's suit has some red stripes on it, but as you can see, his Leva also has a red stripe. What I'm fishing out now, Jack, is another new piece of hardware that we're taking along this time as a result of some comments made on Apollo 12 flight. What Fred is opening up is a drink bag that we place inside of our neck ring that will allow us to drink while we're on the lunar surface. They, Pete and Al, did not have that in Apollo 12, and they consequently got very thirsty. But we hope to alleviate that situation by having our own little bag of water, which with very little effort we can have a sip or two while we're looking around and doing our geology work. Funny noises, it's just probably the drink bag. Okay, Jack, I'm looking out the right window now, and not too far off in the distance now. You can see the objective. And I'll zoom in on it here a little and see if it brings it in better.
Jim, it's been a real good TV show. We think we ought to conclude it from here now. What do you think?
Roger, sounds good. And this is the crew of Apollo 13. Wishing everybody there a nice evening. And we're just about ready to close out our inspection of Aquarius and get back to a pleasant evening at Odyssey. Good night.
WNBC-TV, New York.
It was 10:08 Eastern Time Monday night, 55 hours and 55 minutes after liftoff. At that point, Apollo 13 and her crew were 205,000 miles out from Earth and traveling at 2,400 miles an hour. There was a bang aboard the spacecraft, and the men in the command module heard it. Alarms went off, indicator needles flickered and spun. Mission Control got the word from Commander James Luffel.
Okay, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Mm-hmm. Houston, we've had a problem. We've had a main B bus undervolt.
Roger, main B undervolt. Okay, stand by, 13. We're looking at it.
Okay, right now, Houston, the voltage is looking good. And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there. And as I recall, main B was the one that had a amp spike on it once before.
Roger, Fred.
In the interim here, we're starting to go ahead and button up the tunnel again.
Roger.
Yeah, that jolt must have rocked the sensor on see now on O2 quantity 2, it's was oscillating down around 20 to 60%. Now it's full scale high again.
Roger.
And Houston, we had a restart on our computer. We had a pink light and the restart reset.
Roger, restart and a pink light. Restart on a pink reset.
And I'm looking at our service module RCS helium 1. We have B is Bobber Pole, and D is Bobber Pole. Helium 2, D is Bobber Pole, and secondary propellants, I have A and C Bobber Pole. T-Mag temperatures.
Okay, AC2 is showing zip. I'm trying to reconfigure on it, Jack.
Roger.
Yeah, we got a main bus A undervolt now, too, Sean.
Main A undervolt.
It's reading about 25.5. Main B's reading zip right now.
Stand by one, Jim. 13, Houston, we'd like you to attempt to reconnect fuel cell 1 to main A and fuel cell 3 to main B. Verify that quad delta is open.
Okay, Houston, I'm showing, I tried to reset and fuel cell 1 and 3 are both showing gray flags, but they're both showing zip on the flows.
We copy. 13, Houston, we'd like you to open circuit fuel cell 1. Leave 2 and 3 as is.
Okay, I'll get to work on that.
Can I listen to you looking out the hatch that we are venting something? We are venting something out into space.
Roger, we copy your venting.
It's a gas of some sort.
The calm voices from the command module indicated that hardly anything was wrong, but at mission control, the computers were already telling the real story, and the astronauts were indeed in very serious trouble. A sudden explosion in the service module had crippled the main spaceship's electrical system, and Jim Hart has more on that.
This is the panel where the tanks are located. It was either one of these or one of these. And according to a description later received, this entire panel was blown away, which meant that the main stores of electrical power, water, and oxygen on the spacecraft were disabled. And the only backup system was in the command module, and that had a reserve only for the re-entry. So the astronauts had to depend upon the slot supplies that were in the lunar module. And we have with us tonight one of the men who was in on the original design of the LEM, Mr. Tom Kelly of the Grumman Aerospace Corporation. Tom, when did you first visualize the LEM as being a backup system in a situation such as this?
Well, Jim, we knew right from the beginning that the LEM had some additional capabilities to handle emergencies. And in early 1964, which was about 1 year after we at Grumman began work on the project, the NASA put together a mission planning task force to look at the LEM and the rest of the Apollo system and determine what emergency and contingency situations it could handle. In the process of doing this, we quickly determined that we had enough rocket propulsion capability on LEM to back up the main rocket engine in the service module. From that point, it was a question of looking at the other supplies on board, the water, the oxygen, and the electrical power, to make sure that we could handle the entire coast home.
So what we had now was a craft that had been designed to support two men for 48 hours, and it kept three men alive for about 80 hours on this mission.
Yes, that's right.
Did you learn anything from this mission to make any changes, perhaps for the future on the LEM, or were you satisfied with its performance?
Well, we were very satisfied with the LEM's performance, very pleased. The only small thing we might do the next time is save the astronauts the trouble of fabricating a lithium hydroxide canister adapter, which they put together with masking tape right on board the spacecraft.
Mr. Kelly was in on the original design of the lunar module, and throughout this week, his plans and those of Grumman have paid off remarkably well for the astronauts. Frank?
At this point, Apollo 13 and her crew were very close to being lost in space. The command module with its big engine was unusable for the moment, and their hybrid trajectory was due to swing them around the moon on a course that would miss the Earth by 40,000 miles. So 5.5 hours after the accident, they used the main descent engine on the little lunar module to correct their course and put them back into a free return trajectory towards Earth. At 3:43 Tuesday morning, 216,000 miles from Earth, the engine fired, and they were on a new course. That would have brought them down in the Indian Ocean about 1:30 Saturday morning. Since their consumables were so tight and the recovery forces were in the Pacific, not the Indian Ocean, they decided to change matters. They considered a super-fast burn that would have landed them about noon on Thursday. But they settled on what they did, a medium-fast burn designed to set them down in the Pacific around 1 o'clock Friday afternoon. So, 230,000 miles out from Earth and a long way from home, they fired the lunar module's descent engine at 9:41 Tuesday night, and it worked. They were headed for a Pacific splashdown on Friday. But that course was not quite correct. They were going to miss the corridor, that narrow angle they had to squeeze through for a safe landing. They were due to pass 100 miles from Earth, close but not close enough to avoid skipping out into space once again. And it was the furthest away any space mission had ever been from its necessary flight path. So another mid-course correction was necessary. They had to subtract 7.8 feet a second from their velocity of 4,440 feet a second. So at 11:32 Wednesday night, they fired their engine and changed their speed by 7.6 feet a second, just 2.5 inches a second less than what they needed. It was a success, and they were back in the corridor with only 176,000 miles left to go. We'll have a look at the end of the trip after this message from Gulf.
I'm an able-bodied sailor, and they've often crossed the line on whaling ships and sailing ships and ships of every kind. But now I've got the very best job I've had for many a day. I'm working on the tanker, bringing oil to Fancy Bay.
Hey, bringing home the oil, they buy, bringing home the oil. Sailing all around the world, bringing home the oil. Oh, work, they're not a giant ship, it's very hard we find. It's sailing into Fancy Bay.
She is the biggest ship, me lad, that ever sailed the
seas. Yet graceful as a swan she goes, we sail her at our ease. From Araby around Cape Hope we proudly make our way. We keep all Europe moving from our base in Bantry Bay.
Hey, bringing home the Isle me by, bringing home the Isle. Sailing all around the world, bringing home the Isle. Working on a giant ship that's very hard we pile. And sailing into Bantry Bay, bringing home the Isle.
Other tankers now to speed more oil to you. The universe, Kuwait, Milad, Japan and Portugal too. Also the universe, Ireland, I'm very proud to say, is among the giant ships that's bringing oil to Bantry Bay.
Hey, bringing home the oil, bringing home the oil. Sailing all around the world, bringing home the oil. A working on a giant ship, it's very hard we pile. Sailing into Bantry Bay, bringing home the oil. A working on a giant ship that's very hard we find. A sailing into Bantry Bay, bringing home the isle.
Once the astronauts were on a true course back to Earth, they would have to face another critical test, the actual re-entry sequence. Because of the command module power failure, the astronauts would stay with the LEM as long as possible before entering the Earth's atmosphere. The re-entry sequence was extremely demanding and had never been done in space before. Jim Hartz is here again, and along with his models, can give us details of how it went.
As the spacemen returned to the Earth, this was the configuration. The lunar module, the command module, and the service module. This is the part that was damaged. At about 4 hours before re-entry, they jettisoned this section of the spacecraft, and it floated away. And it was at this point that the command lunar module hooked together, turned and photographed the section of the spacecraft that had been blown apart by the explosion. A short while after that, the separation of the command module. For the first time during the mission, they were on internal power within this, the batteries, the oxygen and water supplies in here, and there was a detectable note of sorrow in their voices as the Aquarius, the lunar lander, drifted away. Both the LEM and the service module burned up on re-entry, which left the astronauts in this spacecraft set to splashdown. And for the story on the re-entry and the splashdown, here's NBC News correspondent Sandra Van Ocker.
As Frank said, the last time any of us had seen Apollo 13 was Monday night during a television transmission just before the ordeal began. And when it began, there was worldwide concern. Many nations, including the Soviet Union, offered to help out if the spaceship missed the landing zone. But today, Apollo 13 reappeared in a dramatic return to Earth. And the world watched as a small extension, perhaps of all of us, descended into the Pacific Ocean, 550 miles southeast of American Samoa.
Apollo 13, this is recovery, and your chutes look good.
Roger.
Report from the Iwo Jima that Apollo 13 is descending at a point 4 miles due south of the ship.
Photo 1, sir. Splice down at this time.
I'll take up parity.
Roger.
Another cheer in the control room as we had splashdown.
Photo 1, splice down at this time. The freak shoes are displaced. They're in the water.
Frogmen were by the Apollo in about 3 minutes. They dropped in the water and they attached a sea anchor to prevent drift and then a flotation collar to stabilize the spacecraft. And then old Reliable 66, which has participated in many of these operations after splashdown, hovered over as the astronauts jumped into the rubber life raft, which had been attached to the spacecraft.
Okay.
And the lift was lowered down.
Direct your head in this hand.
Pick up the first astronaut to take him up to the helicopter and recover the ball.
The first astronaut is climbing aboard. Signal has been given. Ready for lift.
up.
Swigert came up next.
Recovery, I have astronaut Swigert on board. He reports to Field 5.
And finally, in the tradition of the seas, the commander, Commander Lovell, was last here. The helicopter took about 10 minutes to get back. The mission control watched. It took that long so the men could get into their blue uniforms and set their spacecraft. This is aboard the Iwo Jima. Their faces tell the whole story.
They certainly look great.
Glad to be aboard again.
Jim? I want to say a, just a brief welcome note to you, not just from the recovery force, but to millions and millions of people all over the world. It undoubtedly has to be one of personally happy moments. We're glad you could make it, boy.
Thank you.
Jim, I must commend you on your navigation. Welcome on board Iwo Jima. I would like to ask the captain to say a real brief prayer of thanks.
Survive the dangers encountered in their mission and return to us safe and whole. We offer our humble thanksgiving for this successful place over here.
Mission is over, and the men are safe on the Iwo Jima. Fred Hayes is suffering from a slight fever, but they say nothing serious. The other men are tired, but feeling well, and all of us are glad that their ordeal is behind them. We'll be back after this message from Gulf.
NBC News special program will continue after station identification. This is the NBC Television Network.
What looks like ground roast coffee, sounds like ground roast coffee, smells like ground roast coffee, and tastes like ground roast coffee.
Ground roast coffee, right?
Wrong. Introducing the Fooler. Taster's choice. The freeze-dried coffee. Good enough to fool you.
Are you sure this isn't ground roast coffee?
Taster's choice. The new freeze-dried coffee from Nestle. It's got everything ground roast coffee has, except the grounds.
Introducing the world's second 747. The only 747 that doesn't fly. Hertz $7.47 a day vacation rate. If the Boeing 747 is revolutionizing vacation travel in the air, the Hertz 747 may do it with a Ford on the ground.
The Dreyfus Fund is a mutual investment fund. Ask your securities dealer for a free prospectus.
WNBC-TV, New York.
In the 50 minutes or so of this report, we've been discussing and evaluating what occurred after the accident last Monday night. In short, we've been dealing with the past. What happened, what might have happened, what did or what did not take place. All of this is in the past now. It's irretrievable. It's a part of history. And we would like now to consider the future. Thomas Paine, administrator of NASA, has already announced that a special investigating board is being formed to inquire into all aspects of the still unexplained accident aboard Apollo 13. It is still not clear whether Apollo 14 will meet its schedule or be delayed. It was clear today that there will be no more moon flights until the precise trouble has been determined and steps taken to ensure that it doesn't happen again. In short, there probably is a new chapter of space history being written tonight. What happened Monday night and in the days and nights that followed was too dramatic, too close to be permitted to happen again. NBC News correspondent Robert Gorowski is standing by in Washington with a scientist who, as much as anyone of our generation, has dedicated his life to the people.
Well, there can be cases where a rescue capability isn't very useful. You see, this explosion happened 205,000 miles away from the Earth. It would have taken days for any rescue craft to get there. And now, had the accident, for instance, happened after a successful lunar landing, when the command and service module were all on their own without the LEM standing by, there would have been tragedy long before any rescue craft could have reached the vehicle. So I think the message is very clear. Make the basic vehicle reliable through redundancy and basic good design and quality control, and don't depend on outside help.
Well, this problem had really been anticipated, had it not through computers long ago.
Well, I would say in more general terms, I think nobody in the program had any illusions that sooner or later there would be some setbacks. And I think we can only be very grateful that in this particular case, the setback took the benign form it did and didn't lead to tragedy.
What happens beyond the Apollo program right now? How do you foresee America's future space program, Dr. Vaughan?
Many faceted program that will continue of continued manned space activities. First place, there will, of course, be more flights to the moon. And we are developing a vehicle that in due time will enable us to fly to orbit on a repeated basis, almost like an airliner, where you don't throw rocket stages away as you go, but fly the whole craft up to orbit and return to Earth to refuel it and fly again, and do that maybe 100 times. In this fashion, the cost of manned space flight can be vastly reduced. In addition, I think space flight, manned and unmanned, will prove itself very valuable for science and for practical application on Earth. Things like crop survey, oil prospecting, mineral prospecting, forest surveys, check whether parts of forests are infected by tree diseases, these kind of things, Earth-related applications.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Von Braun. Werner Von Braun, the planning chief of the National Space Agency. Robert Gorelski, NBC News in Washington.
There are, in this country and overseas, a number of persons, and well-qualified persons, who maintain that manned space flights are not necessary, that computers in space could do the same job. One of these is Dr. Philip Abelson, editor of Science Magazine. He discusses this now with NBC News correspondent Ron Nesson in Washington.
What do you think should be the future of man in space?
Certainly in terms of exploring the far distant planets, this is a job to be done by the instrumented vehicles. If anything comparable to this accident that occurred recently were to have taken place when the men were in the vicinity of Mars, it would have been just too bad. It's my opinion that we have been sending up the recent Apollo vehicles too rapidly. That is, we did not reap all the benefits to be achieved from the Apollo 11 mission before the Apollo 12 mission went. And the scientists examining the lunar specimen have just fully got to work on the Apollo 12 when the Apollo 13 mission was dispatched.
Well, how frequently do you think we should make trips to the moon?
Oh, perhaps 8 months, frequencies of 8 months to a year. Now, I realize there may be engineering problems that cause the space people to want to do it more frequently, but certainly from the scientific standpoint, 8 months or a year would be more satisfactory.
Can you get the samples back and do the other exploration of the moon and beyond with instruments, with machines?
It would be possible to get samples back from the moon with machines. There would be a development period perhaps of 8 to 10 years before the such a machine could be made. And this would be a project that would be in the multi-billion dollar class. It would not be a cheap project, but it could be done without man.
Aren't you afraid that if you do it all with instruments and machines that they don't have the ability to correct themselves as land does?
Well, while it is true that there was some action by the astronauts, and we shouldn't knock their contribution, the fact is that the bulk of the orders and the bulk of the thinking was done in Houston. We shouldn't forget that. In fact, the whole trend in the space program has been toward giving more and more of the decision-making to Houston rather than to the astronauts. The original flight's intention was to lean very heavily upon the pilot, but that has proven not to be feasible in view of the complexity and complications of these flights.
Isn't it true that the whole history of man has been to go and find out about things he doesn't know about and to go to places he hasn't been? How are you going to turn that back?
Well, that's pretty difficult to turn back. Of course, for example, if we try to go into the sun, however, we get closer and closer to the sun, it gets dreadfully hot. This is really no place for a man, or it's like going to hell. There's no place for man. Nor is it such a hot idea to go to the far distant reaches of the solar system. It's terribly, terribly cold, and the problems that arise in attempting to maintain suitable conditions for man sharply increase.
In other words, you think man should draw a line and say he's not going to go any farther than that, and that line should be at the moon?
I would say that that's a good practical line at this time.
And we'll be back after this message from Gulf.
The Monastery of La Rábida. Columbus waited here 6 years until the friars convinced the queen that his voyage would be good for Spain. He sailed from the Rio Tinto, where tankers sail today. Gold tankers.